modern man does not. Just can't be understood. The very theory that modern man does not. Because you'd be fighting what is, whether you call it God or anything. And modern man, beginning with the energy particle, and saying everything must be reduced finally to this, or with some form of pan-everythingism, has no basis for fighting social evil. And some of you here that I look at, and I know you very, very well, where were you 45 years ago? You really thought you could fight social evil, didn't you? I can see you out there with those banners, I can see you with those placards, walking up and down, shouting, knowing you were going to fight social evil. Where are you now? Where's all the marching? What killed it? What killed it is the fact that when you get down in the nitty-gritty of the stuff, they have no basis for fighting social evil. Fighting social evil is a romanticism worse than love story in a certain sense at this point. Well, don't laugh about love story. Love story is very important in our moment of history. You better understand love story and where it came from if you're going to do any evangelization in the next 15 years. To get on. But let us notice then, we have a basis for fighting social evil. Well, then we must fight it. Because we're the ones who can fight social evil without fighting God. We are saying this is abnormal and I can fight it without fighting what is, and I can fight it without fighting God. Not only that, we have norms in the scripture for fighting it. We can fight evil without fighting God, for God did not make things as they now are. Man in his cruelty is the result of that cruelty is abnormal to what God made. Now at this particular place, we must again bring in Christ at the tomb of Lazarus. The Bible makes it very, very plain, and if you want more on this, look at it. I've gone over it in almost every one of my books because it's so crucial. Christ claims to be God, and yet standing at the tomb of Lazarus, the Greek makes plain that he not only wept, but he was furious. The Greek word won't stand anything else. Two things. He cried, and he was angry. If you want a really scholarly reading of this, look in. You can look in some of the old Princeton studies. At this point, I'm word studies. I give references in one of my volumes. The Christian should be the one in the forefront of fighting the result of man's cruelty, for we know that it is not what God made. Don't you see how it turns? And one thing that has bothered me to death is that evangelicals have done so poorly here. We know that this is abnormal. We know that it's not what God made. We know Christ can stand in the front of the tomb of Lazarus and be angry as well as cry. Where are the tears and where's the anger? Now, the rub comes, of course, that with the anger, and egoism very easily comes in the selfishness, because we too are sinners. But there ought to be something here. There ought to be something here. We're able to be angry at the results of man's cruelty without being angry at what God is or what man was normally in what God made. All this flows from the Christian point of an abnormality, because of man's own choice. Four. Now we can have real morals. Four. Now we can have real morals. And moral absolutes. For God now is the absolutely good God, with a total exclusion from God of evil. You see? Now we have a totally good God, the very opposite of Baudelaire. This is where we struggle. This is where we fight Baudelaire. No, not back in his proposition on the basis of his own presuppositions. So now we have a totally good God with evil excluded from God. God's character is now the moral absolute of the universe. It is not possible to have morals as morals without an absolute. Plato is right at this place. But where are you going to find the absolute? It is completely contrary, however, to Plato trying to find a place to find absolutes and not being able to do so. Why couldn't Plato ever find a place for moral absolutes? He could never find a place for moral absolutes And I'll repeat myself here, but in this setting, because his gods were not big enough. But here we have the infinite personal God, who has a character, mind you, who has a character. With all evil excluded from him, and thus his character is the moral absolute of the universe. He is not only the judge, his character is the constitution, as it were, the law. Now be careful here, both in your thinking and your discussion. It is not that there is a moral something back of God, because in this case, then whatever that thing was would be God, because it would bind God as well as men. It is not that. It is rather that the character of God himself is that which is the moral absolute and the law of the universe. Don't make a mistake of this place in your thinking. There never can be anything back of God. Whatever is the final thing back is God, no matter what the words you put to it. It's not this way in Christianity, however. There's not something back of God that binds God morally, any more than in his being. But his own, what he is the moral absolute of the universe. And is in the area of our first lecture in regard to metaphysics. This is the only answer in the area of morals. It is the only answer. That is man in his dilemma. The only answer in the area of morals, man in his dilemma, turns on God existing, being there. There is no other thing. It's this or nothing, just as it was in the area of existence. There is a philosophic necessity in both metaphysics and morals that he is there. That's really tremendous when you think of it. There's a philosophic, totally philosophic necessity that God is there. And it is equally necessary that he is not silent. The name of your member of our study is he's there and he's not silent. This is the God who is there, the book, the God who is there, in its next step, in a certain sense. So therefore, what we find out, therefore, is the factor that it is not only necessary that he's there, however, but he is not silent. And he is not silent. He has spoken in verbalized propositional form and told us what his character is. And then this becomes our moral law, our moral standard. But we wouldn't know what his character was unless he told us, and especially after man rebelled and we're surrounded by the cruelty with which we're surrounded. And the whole universe has become abnormal. If God has not spoken in verbalized propositional terms, we wouldn't have a clue of what his character was. He must be there and he must speak. And we must notice here that it is not enough merely to speak of God revealing himself in Christ. But we need the propositional verbalized communication from God to man in the Bible. There's no conflict between the two things. But we need both. We need both. We need the propositional verbalized communication from God in the Bible and the revelation of God in Christ put into verbalized propositional terms, as Jesus himself did, to tell us who he is, the infinite personal triune God, and what his character is. Now, I'm very, very distressed more and more. Let's reverse the trend of evangelicalism. We have again been influenced without knowing it. And that is, you listen to many, many great Christian leaders today, and they will stand up, and they're concerned about this whole drift. And they'll stand up in front of a great student body, I've heard it done, and pray, and say, God, morning after morning in a chapel service, God, we thank you for the revelation of God in Christ. And no longer do I hear evangelicals thanking God very carefully for the propositional revelation in verbalized form in the Scripture. And they don't know what they've done. They've been influenced without knowing it. But you don't know any of these things except as God has spoken in the Bible, first in other ways, and then giving us a record of the verbalized propositional thing that God means, that Christ is said about the character of God as he does reveal the character of God. So be careful here. And let's really carry these things in a very careful practice. Thank God indeed for the revelation of the propositional facts we have of what God is through the revelation of God bodily in Christ. Thank God. But never, never, never ceasing, thank God, also for the verbalized propositional revelation we have in the Scriptures concerning what God is in His character. Thank God for the Scriptures at this place, as well as argue from them. It is not arbitrary, for it is fixed in God Himself. It is fixed in what has always been. This is the complete opposite to all forms of relativism. So the morality, there is a morality that is a real morality. That's our point. We're still on point four, you remember. Isn't it point four? Yeah. It is a morality that is a real morality that is fixed in what has always been. It is the very opposite of the situation where morality is only a relativism because it is something kicked up by the statistical thoughts of men and aspiration of men, contrary to what has always been. It's the complete opposite. Suddenly morals become morals. It's tremendous. Again, as in the area of metaphysics, this is not the best answer, it is the only answer. It is either this, or morals or not morals, but only sociological averages, or arbitrary standards imposed by the state or by society. And there are no other answers. It's one or the other. It's one or the other. Either the Christian answer finally is going to be right and is right. It is either this, or morals are not morals, mind you, but either only sociological averages or arbitrary standards imposed by something, the state or society. It's not the best answer, it's the only one, unless you're going to, or the other, only other thing is this awful, awful hole. It is not, and then we pass on to the conclusion now, it is not improper for men to ask these questions in the area of metaphysics or morals and morals. And we as Christians should point out that there is no answer to these questions except that He is there and He is not silent. Never say to anybody, shut up, these questions are improper or they're irreligious. They're not, as long as they're not being naughty. And the Christian answer shouldn't be just saying keep quiet. We should be pointing out and being able to point out that in these areas of metaphysics and morals, either He's there and He's not silent or there are no answers. But notice, if this is true, then man is just not just metaphysically small, but he is really morally guilty. And he needs a solution for this true moral guilt. So in one word, the modern psychological approach is a real hell. There are no morals against all my moral motion. But you must understand, as soon as you have real morals, on the basis we talked about, you must understand that then we must acknowledge that man has true moral guilt and not just guilt feeling. It's a two-horned dilemma at this point. So either there's no such thing as morals, and this is an awful damnation because you feel the need of morals, or on the other hand, as soon as there are morals, then in this you have this moral absolute. You're guilty, not merely psychologically guilty, the way your shrink might tell you, but you turn around on the other side and you really have moral guilt before somebody who's there, and no longer just guilt feelings. Now, as soon as you, incidentally, I like shrinks, don't. All right, to get on. As I have said, it is here that the substitutionary, propitiatory death of Christ is needed and fits in. It's just at this point. There is nothing wrong with being metaphysically small or being finite, for that is the way God made us in the first place. But we do need a solution for our true moral guilt before the absolutely good God who is there. And thank God, God has given us the solution. But if it's going to be a solution, then it must be truly a substitutionary propitiatory death that takes care of what? Of true moral guilt. The only way to escape the need for such a thing from God, and it's a gift from God, is to say there is no moral guilt, only guilt feelings, but then you're in the swamp of the other thing we have tried to describe. You know, evangelicals are so foolish when we think we're going to answer the real questions by toning down on the real answers. But notice in conclusion, as in the area of metaphysics, the answer was not just the word God, but in the content God has told of himself as being the infinite personal God and the Tri and then the Trinity. If you're taking notes, please, and if you're not taking notes, listen to this one again. But notice, as in the area of metaphysics, the answer is not just in the word God. The word God does not do anything except just another trip. Let me keep repeating. The word God doesn't help it. But it is in the area of metaphysics, the answer was not just in the word God, but in the content. Our evangelism must be in our personal work and our talking and our teaching, must every 6 months be tougher, thought out content. It's the kind of generation we live in because it's moving in exactly the opposite direction. Content is what we need. Where does the content come from? What's what God has told us of himself as being the infinite, personal God and the Trinity. And in the area of morals, we have none of these answers. Now, I was talking about metaphysics there. But in the area of morals, we have none of these answers except on the basis of a true space-time historic fall. Everything turned upon a true space-time historic fall. Or there are no answers for the Christian in the area of morals. Give up these first chapters of Genesis in their strict sense of a true historic space-time fall, and we are in the area of an irrational answer. All we can say is God is good against all reason. So we be careful. It is not a theological abstraction when we are talking about what many evangelicals are doing today in playing games with the first chapters of Genesis. It's anything but an abstraction. And in the area of morals, we have none of these answers except on the basis of a true space-time historic fall. Remove this, and the Christian answer in the area of morals, in the area of man and his dilemma, is gone. It's finished. It turns upon God is there, he is not silent, and there was an unprogrammed man who changed himself. Outside of that, we have no answers in the area of morals. Now, my last sentence. What do we mean by a historic space-time fall? To make just a very short summary, in line with the rest of the lecture, there was a time before the fall. A historic space-time fall requires that man was once normal. Don't you see how it all goes? There must be a time when he was once normal, or there's no answers. But according to this, there is a time before the fall when he was normal. There was a time before the fall, and then man turned from his proper integration point by choice, and in doing so, he became abnormal. That's it. And this is where we are. Now we've come to the place where we have discussed the metaphysical necessity and the moral necessity. And the Lord willing, the next two lectures will deal specifically with the same questions, but in the area of a more profound nature, in a sense, and that is epistemology. And the next lecture, then, will deal with the dilemmas of modern man in the area of epistemology. And then, the Lord willing, Sunday night is the last lecture, the Christian answer. Third lecture on the epistemological necessity, considering the fact of the topic, he is there and he is not silent. He is there and he is not silent.
I'd just like to say that we've gone through two lectures, and though these two lectures are a unit, the next two lectures are a unit quite in themselves, yet it really would be helpful to you if you would have the first two lectures also in mind, because they really constitute a unit. So if there's anyone who's arrived since the beginning of the conference, I would be glad if you would listen to the first two lectures on the philosophic necessity of his being there and his not being silent, in the area of metaphysics and being, existence, and then secondly, the same thing in regard to morals, the man and the dilemma of man. We now come to the fact that it is necessary that he is there and he's not silent in an even more profound realm in a certain sense, and that is the realm of epistemology. And if anyone comes to the conference, please, between now and Sunday night, I would really feel that they must be urged very, very strongly to listen to this lecture prior to the listening to the one Sunday night, or I think much of the force and understanding will be lost. Maybe if those at the desk are hearing this, they can make something of a point of mentioning this to the people who come in and register from this point onward. Now, I notice that here in the tapes that are available of the lectures I gave at Covenant College, that is here, in the spring of 1970, that there are the lectures on epistemology on tape. And, of course, most of you realize this is the way the books are produced, and the way I pray about them, think about them, that after I have the material in what I think is already pretty good shape, I lecture many, many places in different kinds of groups, and then consider whether what needs improvement, and gradually it is improved, till I have my final thing in my own mind and in the manuscripts, and then I'm ready for the books with what I think is some sort of depth. So if you have listened to these lectures or heard me anywhere else except on this trip on the basis of the thinking of epistemology, there will be overlapping, but this will be almost the final form. I think it's the last time I will give these lectures, probably, until it comes out in a book, I hope, in January of 1972. The book will be called He Is There and He's Not Silent. Now to begin, therefore, and we divide the area of epistemology into two areas. First of all, today, modern man's epistemological problem, and tomorrow, the Christian answer, the Christian view of knowing. The Christian answer, the Christian view of owing, not tomorrow, but Sunday night. But today now, rationalistic modern man's epistemological problem. We better define the word epistemology to begin. The word epistemology means the theory of the method or grounds of knowledge. I'll say this very, very slowly because you really ought to have this in your books if you're taking any notes. The word epistemology means the theory of the method or the grounds of knowledge or the theory of knowledge or how we know. Or how we know. And you better have all those in there because they're all very important, really. The theory of the method or grounds of knowledge, the theory of knowledge, or how we know, or how we know we know. Now, epistemology is really the central problem of our generation. And as you know from my previous books in which I flatly made the statement and given a little bit of explanation, and now go deeper into this matter, I'm convinced that the so-called generation gap is really epistemological. It is that the generation in which we are simply looks at the matter of knowing and of knowledge in a way that is radically different from previous ones. And I've dwelt on this question at some length as to the application of this and the so on in my earlier books, especially The God Who Was There and Escape from Reason. So in these two lectures, we'll only touch lightly upon those things I've mentioned in those previous books, except where it is absolutely necessary to make a unity, which is certain, which is true in a few places, a real unity in these lectures for themselves. And this will especially be necessary in the area of Thomas Aquinas. In the High Renaissance, we'll have to have some detail there, more than just a passing word. Now, however, in this, I do want to start further back. I want to go back to the time of the Greeks. So in a way, if you can think of the God who is there, I began with Hegel. And then with Escape, we went back to Thomas Aquinas. And now with our study of epistemology, we want to go back to the Greeks. So in a way, we've worked in reverse order. The first book starts here, the next book goes a step further back, because you must always keep remembering Escape was written after The God Who Was There, even though it was published first. So in my own thinking, we stopped here, here, and now we go back a bit further. We go back to the time of the Greeks and the Greek philosophers. The Greek philosophers spent much time with this problem of knowledge. And the one who wrestled with it most and with the greatest sensitivity was Plato. And Plato really understood this basic problem. He really understood the basic problem. He understood that the basic problem is in the area of knowledge. And that in the area of knowledge, as in the area of morals, there must be more than particulars if there is to be any meaning. It's not only in morals, but in knowledge itself, there must be more than merely particulars if there is to be any meaning. When we speak of particulars in the area of knowledge, we're speaking of the individual things which we see in any given moment. As we cast our eyes around this room, each one of us looking through the two windows, and we cast our eyes around this room, we are faced with millions and millions of particulars. Just millions and millions of particulars. With one glance of my eye, I see millions of particulars, though I may not stop to analyze them all. Now, in other words, the glass of water that's here is a particular, but you are a particular as well with this definition. In other words, it's just all these things which are before us, all the individual things which are before us. Now, the dilemma is a very simple one, and that is, what are the universals which can give these particulars any meaning? So I look here and I go, zip like this, and I see millions and millions and millions and millions of particulars at one glance. Certainly at three glances you see billions, if you could analyze them all, even in this room. And now my problem is, and man's problem is, what are the universals that are going to give these particulars meaning? This is the heart of the problem of epistemology and the problem of knowing. Now maybe we can understand this better, a bit better, by a very closely related problem, and that is how we learn, learning, and how we talk in these areas. Let's think for a moment if I want to speak of apples. Now, there are many, many varieties of apples. I do not know them all, but I'm sure if we pooled our knowledge, we could think of perhaps how many? 500 varieties of apples, 400 or 300 anyway. Queen of Canada, sheep nose, you know. Delicious. There's a lot of apples. So now we have these here. We have different kinds of apples. Now, every time I want to use the word apples and include the whole, or even if I want to use the singular and say apple, I could easily go through. I could say I am talking about the apple, or I'm talking about apples. And by this, I mean sheep nose, queen of Canada, yellow delicious, blum, blum, blum. And about 20 minutes later, I'd say, that's it. But it's a bit awkward. And so consequently, what we have learned to do, both in learning and in talking, and in assimilating, is to move from the particulars of Queen of Canada, yellow delicious or whatever there is, sheep nose, etc., 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 and we simply list all these under the word apples. And this may sound very simple, but believe me, it's not simple. It's a very profound and it's a very, very, very difficult thing to plumb to the depths of all that's involved in this. Incidentally, it is also exactly the way a child learns. A child learns by drawing particulars into linguistic symbols. It's curious, but if you watch a child, or if you take a stranger, let's say, into, well, and I take someone who's just come to Switzerland, if I go hiking with him in the woods, what's he always doing? Asking me the name of this tree, the name of that tree, the name of the other tree. And then he takes the names and he tries to lump them together. And gradually you bring it together and you learn and you feel that you really have some control over this and you bring in the associations of it through the language and through bringing them together under universals. Now, of course, you can go next and we come to pears. And I don't know a name as many pears as I do apples, with thought, but I'm sure somebody here could tell me, I guess. I'm sure there must be, I guess, 100 kinds of pears anyway. I don't know. I haven't a clue. And then you could come to the same with plums. And you could come to the same of all kind of things. All kind of things, you see. So you run through and we could still be talking. So what we could say is, if we're coming in learning and we are really associating these things and we're coming to the place of comprehension, looking at them and talking about them, we are moving from these particulars now to universals, so we don't say all these varieties, and we don't say all these varieties, and we don't say all these varieties. We just do this. But now that's awkward too. I do not say there are in the world a certain kind of thing which we can eat from trees, and they are apples, pears, plums, oranges, grapefruit, tangerine, mandarine, ding, 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 like this. It's very simple. We suddenly learn to say fruit. And immediately you know something. You know these are bound together. There's something more profound here than merely language. This is the way the child learns. This is the pedagogy of a child's personal assimilation into the world. But it's a linguistic thing too, of course, but it's deeper than linguistic. It has to do not only with learning, but knowing. But knowing. So now we have run through this whole thing. So now we have come to the place in which we speak of particulars. We have lumped them under these, and now we have lumped them under the term fruit. Now I want to show you something, because it's important to see, and that is it's exactly the same thing in the area of science. There's no difference. Anyone who thinks that science is too different, of course, really doesn't understand. Science is not completely different from all other knowledge. It's not a holy kind of a knowledge which is entirely different by any means. It has all the problems of any kind of knowing, and of knowing you know. So now let us come, and instead of this, we make it into the scientific structure. And what we've got, let us say that we have a certain number of particulars, and in a certain year, a scientist came along and very brilliantly united together under a law. And here is a law. And here is a law. And then a more brilliant science comes along later, scientist comes along later, and he puts it into another larger law. And everything, don't you see, there's no real difference in moving from particulars to universals, whether it is in the child learning or the highly sophisticated scientist learning. It makes no difference. It really makes no difference. And there's no other way to learn. And there's no other way to know about knowledge, starting from man himself. Of course, eventually you get to the place where men have a tremendous, tremendous longing for the super laws. And the reason it's important to have the super laws is that you are moving always towards a greater and higher, unities. So let us call these things. Let's think of Newton. It's crudely done. I did the other night on the board, but let's try it again. Newton and those who worked in the area of electricity. Faraday, let's make it Faraday, it'll do. And over here, let us put those who worked in another area. Now, what we have is that the men want to come along and they want to make super laws. Super laws, not only so that we can talk easier, mind you, because talking easier is relating to knowing and really knowing, but not only so we can talk easier, but because we want a universal that will tie all these particulars together so that we can see greater and greater associations, greater and greater unity in that we feel this gives us, and it does in a real way, if we have a right base, greater knowledge. So, of course, then you come to Einstein, as I pointed out, and Einstein united everything there's ever been under two super laws, that is, in the seen world, and the one, of course, was electromagnetism, and the other was gravity. He never was able to bring them together. But don't you see what I've said over and over now? I've tried to show you. Learning is something that not only you must see particulars, but you must find some ways to have universals, in whether you're the child learning, whether it's in pedagogy, whether you're coming along and you are learning the new trees as you come to Switzerland and as you look at them, you have new trees there, or whether it's in a highly degree, a very proud science indeed, way up here in an area that is considered very proud and very high in many ways, many people's way of thinking. So now, whether we're talking about apples or about science, in learning we're constantly moving from particulars to universals. Always. Always this is the way we move. Now notice this is not only a linguistic thing, it is really the way we know. It is not just an abstract theory or some kind of scholasticism, but the matter of actually knowing and knowing that we know. And this is the rub. It is not only the way of knowing, but it is the way of knowing that we know. You must be able to achieve something in this area, or you do not. It isn't just that you don't know, but you don't know you know. The Greek philosophers, and especially Plato, were seeking universals which would give the particulars, which would make the particulars meaningful. Now we can understand that we can understand this very, very easily in the area of morals. And in my previous lecture, the last one, I dealt much in the area of morals. That we need universals, which in this area of morals we speak of as absolutes, if we're to determine what is right and what is wrong. We pointed out that in the area of morals, if you don't have absolutes or universals, the modern concept is that morals only is sociological. I can access the statistics of public opinion of right and wrong, and a majority then determines moral questions. Or we can think of an elite emerging to tell us what is right and what is wrong. But both these approaches are merely matters of averages. The Greeks understood that for really to know what is right and what is wrong, we have to have a universal which will cover all the particulars in the area of morals. Now, it's rather easily seen there. But while it is more easily seen, pardon me, in the area of morals, and most people have a sense of it there, especially in our generation when they're being battered because their children are asking them what the universals are and they don't have any universals for most of their memory in the area of morals or mores. While it is more easily seen in the area of morals, it is the same thing and more important in the area of knowledge. And this is what most people don't understand. They can feel it in the area of morals, especially when the child shouts something at them, why should I do so-and-so? And they think wildly, what's the universal? They may not know the word universal. They may not have even thought of the word absolute. But boy, they're searching for one. While the children are walking on their corns at this point. And all the time they're searching for it, what they're doing is going through Plato's dilemma without ever knowing anything about Plato. But you see, you must understand that it is not only the case in the area of morals, which would be relatively simple. And as I say, almost everybody has some sense of this, even if they wouldn't know words and understand the problem. It is even more basic and just as definite in the area of knowledge. And that is, how can we find universals which are large enough to cover the particulars which I see, blip like this and see a billion particulars or more particulars than a billion, I'm sure, if we counted them all, we see just in this room. How can we find universals then in the area of knowledge to cover the particulars so that we can know we know? Now here's our problem. It's modern man's problem, it's man's problem as a whole. Plato, for example, put forth the concept of ideals, which would provide the needed universal. For example, in his concept of ideas or ideals, because in Platonic thinking you can use either ideas or ideals, rather interchangeably if you take the whole scope of Platonic thinking through the years. For example, let us think of chairs. We've talked of apples, we've talked of pears, we've talked of grapefruit, tangerines, and some we could talk of cabbages and kings, and we have come to electromagnetism and gravity. But now let us talk about chairs. Let us talk, all these would fall under the name particulars. Thinking of chairs, in the Plato put forth the concept that there is somewhere an ideal chair, and that this ideal chair would cover all the particulars of all the chairs that ever were and ever will be. Thus, a chair has meaning in reference to the ideal chair and not to a particular one. Do you understand where I'm going now? What is a chair? You think that's simple? You're crazy. You know, really. Thus, a chair has meaning in reference to the ideal chair or an ideal chair and not to a particular one. So when we use the word chair, there is a meaning that is beyond our mere gathering of the particulars about chairs. Now, this was Plato's solution. An ideal somewhere that would cover all the possible particulars that anybody could ever possibly find out about chairs. There would be a chair, there would be no chair outside of this universal or beyond the concept that was covered by the ideal chair. Anything out of this was simply not a chair. Could be something else, but not a chair. Now, this was Plato's concept. It was a brilliant one. It was absolutely brilliant. There is something called a chair that can be a universal that will cover all possible varieties of the particulars in particular chairs. Absolutely brilliant. Now we can see from the air of parallel and morals and from the problem that arises. And that is, where are you going to place this ideal chair? And the Greeks thought of two ways to try to come to this. One was the first, the sense of the polis, P-O-L-I-S. It's the Greek word meaning city. By definition, if you look it up in your Greek dictionary, you'll find it says city. But the concept of the polis, as I stressed in a certain point, in Death in the City, in the Greek thinking, was finally much more than merely the geographical location of a city. It was the social structure, because to them, the city was the structure. The city was the structure. They moved into their Greek cities, and the city became the structure. It represented everything for a sociological structure to the Greek mind. This is the polis. So when you speak of the Greek polis, it is not just an individual in this sense. It's not just a city geographically, but it means the structure of society. And there were some Greeks who thought that it would be perfectly possible to find the ideal, the concept of morals and knowing in the polis, that society itself could supply the universal. But soon, the Greeks were smart enough to see that there was a problem, that this was not going to go, that it was totally unsatisfactory, whether in the area of morals or in the area of knowledge. Because quickly, of course, if the universal is fixed in the polis, there's everything. They couldn't even figure out what was right and wrong in this area for themselves, let alone anybody else. And surely then they were not big enough in the area of epistemology in knowledge either. In other words, all the classical gods put together were not really enough. And this, as I've continually pointed out, is the reason why in reading in the Greek literature concerning the fates were important in Greek literature, you never, never, never find a clear statement at any point whether the fates are back of the gods or the gods are back of the fates. Never, never, never. You don't know who controls what. Are the gods controlled by the fates
Or is it the other way, and are the faiths controlled by the gods? Are the faiths simply a vehicle of action by the gods, or are the gods under the universals laid down by the faiths? Nobody in the Greeks never came to the end of this. There's a constant confusion between the faiths and the gods. A constant confusion between the faiths and the gods as to final control. And this expresses the Greeks' deep comprehension that their gods were simply not big enough. They were not big enough in regard to the faiths because they were not big enough in the area of knowledge. It's not morals that's basic here. It's knowledge that's basic here. At this point, the Greek gods were simply not big enough in regard to knowledge. Therefore, although Plato and the Greeks understood the necessity of finding a universal, and saw that unless there was a universal, nothing was going to turn out right, they never could find a place where the universal could come, from which it come, either for the polis or for the gods. Now, at this moment, we skip to Thomas Aquinas, and we're now in the area of the birth of the Renaissance, and in my books, the study in Escape from Reason. Now, I'm skipping over a mass of things, Plotinus, many other things, but for this type of study, we're ready now for Thomas Aquinas. Now, Thomas Aquinas actually picked up the dilemma of the Greek philosophers. He understood the difference in the wrestling of the Greek thinking very clearly. It's Aristotle, Plato, you can see it. See the wrestling there in his formulations. Now, we have stressed in Escape from Reason, we must stress it again at this time, that before this, at the period of the Byzantine had no real interest in particulars. It just had no real interest in particulars. Now, I want to say that in none of my books so far have I dealt with the Gothic, because the Gothic must be seen between the Byzantine and the Renaissance art, but it doesn't change anything in any of the books, and I won't even go into it here. The early Gothic especially simply didn't touch at this point, and by the time you get to the Gothic in Florence, most of the Gothic in Florence, it rather flows into what I'm going to say anyway, because the Gothic there was a little later than, say, in France, around Paris. So skipping the Gothic, it doesn't matter. My statement is accurate, though I realize the Gothic is not dealt with. So therefore, before the time of Thomas Aquinas, the Byzantine had no real interest in particulars. They lived in the midst of them, but they really had an entirely different thought form. They were not interested in nature or in this sense in the particular. And we can thank Thomas Aquinas for the fact that because of his view, nature was brought again into importance in man's thinking. Now, in Thomas Aquinas, we have to say thank you for something and then see what he's done, which has opened this awful floodgate right down into the modern generation and your hang-ups, if you're in this generation. But with one thing we must do, we must say thank you, Thomas Aquinas, because you again made nature important. And in this, he was not wrong, he was right, because the Bible makes nature important too. And then in parenthesis, I'd ask you at this place, those of you who know my books, put in everything I said in my the Christian view of ecology, because it all fits right here, right at this point. So therefore, we must understand that Thomas Aquinas' emphasis upon nature at this point was far from wrong. It was very, very right indeed. Now, gradually, as Thomas Aquinas' emphasis spread, and here I am repeating from Escape from Reason, it began to be understood. And it began to be understood and dissimulated, that is Thomas Aquinas' view, in the area of the arts. And it spread out this way to the much more general culture than it did merely with Thomas Aquinas' work. So you remember, I've spoken of Cimbeli of 1240 to 1302, and he began to paint in a different way. Then Dante began to write in a different way, from 1265 to 1321. In which nature had its emphasis. All this is to the good, as far as nature having its emphasis. But also, by this time, you already begin to feel that tension between nature and grace. Now, if you don't understand here, and you've never read Escape from Reason, please, before the day's over, you could do it before you go to bed tonight, just read Escape from Reason. And read it carefully, because that's where this fits here. So now you find that you're finding a real concept here of the growth of the worthwhileness and the value of particulars and the particular in nature. But at the same time, you already begin to have this terrible tension of nature and grace. Now, in nature, you have men. A natural cause and effect affecting the world. In grace, you have the heavenly forces. And how these unseen forces affect the world. In nature, you have the body. In grace, you have the soul. But eventually, no matter what else we put under nature and grace, eventually we must always come to this. And that is the end of the question of nature and grace is always in the area of the problem of particulars and universals. Eventually, the nature and grace problem cannot stop short of the question of epistemology. Not only morals, but epistemology, the problem of particulars and universals. So in nature, you find that you have the particulars. In grace, you have the universals. Or universal. Now these men, Shimbui, Dante, and others like Giotto, 1267 to 1337, who followed them, began to emphasize nature. As I've said, this is fine. But there's a problem. A problem. There's that which is good, in the emphasis of God's creation of nature. And therefore, nature's important. We can, looking at it as Christians, can say this is good. But there's that which gradually came and rapidly came then, increasing speed, that which was bad and destructive. Because they were making the particulars, nature, to be autonomous. And thus they were losing the universals that gave the particulars meaning. So they have come down and they placed themselves in an increasingly hopeless position in this area of knowing. And at this point, modern humanism was born. You are a child of this moment, whether you know it or not. Now there's a principle here, which I have stressed, especially in Escape from Reason. And that is that if nature or the particulars are made autonomous from God, then my expression, nature begins to eat up grace. I think it's a good expression, one worth using. Nature begins to eat up grace. Or you can put it in this way. All you're left with is particulars. And universals are gradually lost. Not only in the area of morals, which would be bad enough, but in the area of knowing and how you know. Now here you can see the drift toward modern man and his cynicism. It was born back there. Modern cynicism did not begin in Berkeley in 1964. And modern cynicism did not begin either with Hume or any of these men. Modern cynicism began back there at the time of this, what we're describing here in the Renaissance. What we're left with is a mass of particulars, but with absolutely no way to put them together. A mass of particulars, but no way to put them together. So we find that nature by this time is eating up grace in the area of morals, and even more basically, in the area of epistemology as well. Now this is where, as you know, now I'm coming into the God who is there. This is where Leonardo da Vinci is so very important. You must understand that Leonardo da Vinci was indeed the first modern mathematician. Everyone says that. I don't think anyone would debate it that I know. He's the first modern mathematician, and he really understood this problem of which we're talking. He understood it really in a way that shows sheer gleaming genius to understand it so clearly back there at the Renaissance. I'm not reading this back into him from our dilemma of modern cynicism. I'm not. He really understood it. He understood where in the passage of all these 100 years since his own day, up to your day, he understood where everything was going to end up if men failed to find a solution. He would not be surprised with anything that is happening in 1971, in it might be details, but not really in the comprehension. He understood it already these many years ago. And that was his real genius, to understand before his own time. And this is, You must understand that real genius, in the deepest kind of genius in the sense, is a genius to be able to understand by projection properly from your own time onwards. And of course, it comes to its highest place as God gives us some wisdom from His Scriptures, or gives us wisdom from His Scripture at this point as well. But I'm thinking now merely of genius, that God, in the area of natural gifts to men. And Leonardo da Vinci stands out as an amazing man, maybe the most amazing man that ever lived in this area, of really, really understanding beyond his own time. He was a tremendous universal man. So now Leonardo da Vinci did understand. And he understood very clearly that if you begin on the basis of rationalism, and remember my definition of rationalism, is man beginning from himself, even though he is only finite, and trying to gather enough particulars in order to make universals. I've said that in every book I've written, almost every lecture I give, I try to stress. Define carefully the word rationalism in contrast to rationality. But now, having said this, that this is rationalism, that man begins from himself, even though he is finite, and he tries to gather enough particulars in order to make a universal, Da Vinci really understood the beginning on the basis of rationalism, and not having any outside knowledge, you would have only mathematics, only particulars, and this must end up in mechanics. And he understood that just as much as anybody living today. What is this? This is the scream of the university campus when all these things have worked themselves out in society. It is the scream of the university campus that says, you've taken Tim, made me into a machine. But there's no use smashing the computers. The problem is not the computer. The problem is not even the size of the university. The computer is what's in the head of the people who run it, and the students who go there. And then none of these people have they beat Leonardo da Vinci's dilemma. The beginning of the rationalism, you're only going to end up with the mathematics, you're only going to end up with particulars, and you're only going to end up, therefore, finally with mechanics. Now, we use slightly different terms. We say, you made me a machine. Well, he just said, these men use mechanics, but they understood everything involved with what we scream when we scream of the machine. They really understood, and especially Leonardo. In other words, he was so far ahead of his time that he really understood where things were going to go to end up only as a machine. And there were not going to be any universals or meaning at all. There were not going to be any universals or meaning at all in anything if there wasn't a solution found. Simply, Leonardo da Vinci understood that going along on this realm, universals were simply going to be crossed out. So curiously enough, in his genius, Leonardo da Vinci came to be very close in his hope to the place where most modern men live in our own generation. And that is, he said he was going to try to paint the universals. Now notice how close this is to the concept, modern concept, of the upper story experience, as I use the terminology. It can't be to be said, you might say, well, why isn't it the same as modern man? Well, because he still had the hope of binding nature and grace together. I think that's the real distinction. None of these men had given up the hope of binding nature and grace together. I think that is the real distinction. But actually, in his thought world, he was very close to modern man, as he thought, I will paint the universal. Notice that's not very far from the modern man's concept of the upper story experience. So he painted and he painted. What was he doing? He was trying to paint the universal. He actually tried to paint the universal, just as Plato had the idea that if there was going to be a knowledge of chairs, you would have to have an ideal chair somewhere to cover all kinds of chairs. Leonardo understood this, and he said, let man produce the universal. But what kind of man? And remember, he was the first modern mathematician. Did he say, let the mathematician produce the chair, or the universal rather? Never, never, never. He said, let the painter produce it. Isn't that modern? Why did he say this? Well, because he realized that mathematicians were only going to end up with mechanics, as I've said. On the other hand, he realized that the painters were the sensitive men, and he hoped, he thought, that they could produce the universal. Not the mathematical man, but the sensitive man. So notice now, in the area not of art by any means, because it's so great there too, but at this particular place, as we're lecturing on the problem of knowing, Leonardo is a very crucial man in the area of humanistic epistemology. Now, I'm going to do the same thing now here in this slightly different setting as I've done in The Escape from Reason and The God Who Is There, because it must be put in here, and that is, again, to move over and notice how what's happening in the area of science and all this. I've already done that on the board with my description, with my little diagrams, apples and laws, scientific laws. It makes no difference. Now, at this point, we must understand what has happened to science at this place. And first of all, we must see, indeed, the difference between what I call modern science and modern science. And I know I'm repeating grounds, but I do it deliberately in my book. Because I want to show that modern man does not have many problems, he basically has one problem. Modern man does not have many problems, basically he has one problem. And that's what we're trying to get at. And that is there silence? So these four lectures is there, he's there and he is not silent. So now we see the difference between modern science and modern science. Modern science is the original science, in which you had men who believed in the uniformity of natural causes and a limited system, a system that could be reordered by God and by man in the image of God. Man made in the image of God. You can think of my emphasis on Whitehead there. Whitehead's little sentence, in which he says so beautifully, though he himself's not a Christian, you couldn't have ever had the birth of modern science except in the milieu, in the consensus of Christianity. And what's the difference? That Copernicus, Galileo, all the way up to Newton himself, but not the Newtonians perhaps, thought that indeed the universe had been created by a reasonable God, and therefore you could understand the universe by reason. And that was the start of modern science. And Whitehead speaks of this, Oppenheimer speaks of it, and I dwell on it in greater length in another place. But from the time of Newton on, not, as I say, Newton himself, but the Newtonians, we have more and more the concept of the machine until we're left only with a machine. And you move into modern science, in which you have the uniformity of cause and effect, you have the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, including sociology and including psychology, and now man is in the machine. Surely some of you, you've battered your brains to pieces, surely you should have in your university classes, as this has been pushed into you in the area of psychology, in the area of sociology. In other words, the early men, the early scientists, had a concept. Some things were in the machine, some things were not in the machine. Some things were in the machine, some things were not in the machine. There was a God, he was not in the machine, he had made it all. So you could find it out by reason, because he was a reasonable God. Man's made in the image of God, and he was not in the machine either, therefore. In other words, the proper way to say it, if you're a scientist, please note this down carefully, is the fact that the early scientists believed in a cause and effect system in a limited time span. Please take notes carefully if you're interested in the area of science, you're going to talk to scientific friends. A cause and effect system in a limited time span. And that's what men believed for a long, long time. There would have been no science without this concept. And curiously enough, you need both sides of it. There has to be a reason for the cause and effect universe, but there also must not be only a cause and effect universe if you're to really be able to have either real science or knowledge. Now, this is where the world in which we live, in the area of science, has come to today. We no longer believing that they can be sure that the universe is reasonable because it was created by a reasonable God, raises the question that Leonardo da Vinci already understood, and which the Greeks understood before that. And that is, how does the scientist know, on what basis can he know that he knows and that he really knows? How's the scientist going to know? So at this particular point, rationalism made another shift in its philosophy. And rationalism at this point put forth the point in the area of the position, the concept rather, in the area of epistemology, they put forth positivism. Positivism. Now, positivism has many different kinds, ending with logical positivism, but that doesn't change anything. Positivism is a certain idea. Positivism is a theory in the area of knowing, which assumes that we can know facts and objects with total objectivity. Listen again. Positivism is a theory in the area of knowing, which assumes that we can know facts and objects with total objectivity. And modern science, is completely built on this. The old science, the old base is gone because they've given it up, that launched science, and positivism was, they attempted to put it back under this. Now, this is truly a romantic concept. And while it held sway, a rationalistic man felt he stood at least 20 feet tall. So proud. It was based on the notion, without any universals to begin with, nevertheless, even though man is finite, he could reach out and grasp, with his reason, sufficient true knowledge to begin to make universals out of the particulars. And this is the whole concept. And the rationalists, even when I was much younger, if I'd have said they're romantic, they would have screamed. But today, this is where people understand positivism really is. Now, at this particular point, of course, we take another step beyond Leonardo da Vinci, and we come to the discussion in Escape from Reason, the God Who Is There, is Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Jean-Jacques Rousseau took the next step, and that is he changed the formulation of nature and grace into nature and freedom. Now, please shift gears and don't think you've heard it all before. You've heard these things, but in an entirely different context. You've heard it in the area of, let us say, sociology, morals. You've heard it in the context of just a general flow of culture, of understanding our time. But now we're emphasizing a much deeper problem, the problem of how people know anything. And we come, and before you had nature and grace, now you have nature and freedom after Rousseau and afterwards. Now it's just, remember, we're talking about knowledge now. Knowledge, how you know. And we see, that these men came to understand the next thing. And that is that man here, if he's on this lower level, is shut up to the factor that indeed you have nature, and then you have positivism, knowing nature, just by looking, the particulars. But indeed, man began to feel now practically that this was going to lead totally in the area of the machine. Don't you see how we're coming around? Men are beginning now to feel what Leonardo knew would happen. Mechanics. And what you now feel in the street, in the scream of the university. Mechanics. Only machines. Down here in the area of the reason, down here in the area of nature, rather, you're only left with positivism. You're only left with a machine, and you have no real universal. So up here, of course, Jean-Jacques Rousseau put forth the concept of autonomous freedom. Absolute freedom. Not only freedom from revelation, but by every bound of society, the polis. Oh, he just has total freedom. You have the total machine and the total freedom in the area of knowledge as well as other things. This complete autonomous freedom, of course, was shown very easily in Gauguin. We can see him going to Tahiti. What was he getting rid of? Just the restraint of God? Of course not. But the restraint of the polis, which for Gauguin was epitomized by the clear distinctions in France, the highly developed culture of France. So he left France, he went to Tahiti to be rid of the culture, the polis. And in doing this, he practiced the concept of the noble savage, which, of course, Jean-Jacques Rousseau had previously set forth. He got rid of all restraints, he thought. You got rid of the polis. You got rid of God or the gods. It didn't matter. He was getting rid of the lot. And then you're free. But, of course, unhappily, it didn't turn out that way with Gauguin, and we as Christians are not surprised that it did not. It did not turn out the way he expected. Not just in the area of morals, mind you, but in the area of knowledge. This is the thing that we're driving these men on like a great fire. So we have then not only immorals, which shows itself quickly, and as I say, can be more quickly seen, and especially in the area of sexual morality and the resulting sexual anarchy. But not only in that, you have a distinct destructive freedom in other areas as well. In metaphysics, in the area of being, as well as in morals, we're supposed to have absolute freedom. But then the dilemma comes. But how do you know? How do you know what? How do you know anything? How do you know anything? How do you know anything at all? Now we can imagine the Greeks and Leonardo da Vinci and all the Neoplatonists at the time of the High Renaissance coming in and sitting down around Gauguin when he's painting there in Tahiti. And what would they have talked to him about his art? I don't think so. I think they would have talked about something else. They would have asked Jean-Jacques Rousseau and his followers, don't you see what you've done? Don't you see what you've done? Where are the universals? How are you going to know? How are you going to build enough universals out of particulars even for a society to run, let alone build true knowledge, knowledge that you really know and are sure you know? I'm sure that's what Leonardo da Vinci would have talked to Gauguin or any of these men about. Something very basic indeed. Very deep. Very basic to everything else. Now we find it is only a step, really, from men like Gauguin to the whole hippie culture, which is founded on this. The whole hippie culture was founded on this. And that is, there's no universals anywhere. They looked at their polis. Their polis was the United States Society. California, Berkeley, 1963 and 4. They looked at the polis. And they looked at the university professors in the polis. And they looked at the administration who ruled there at that time in Berkeley. And they said to that form of the polis, where are the universals? And they listened. Not a word. Not a word. It was just it's a repetition of the whole thing all over again. So we find it in the hippie culture. They found no universals. They were given no universals. And so we found that man is seen then to be totally hedonistically free. Not only in morals, but also in knowledge, mind you. You understand how some of these young hippies, back there 64, 65, 66, trying to turn someplace else, as we shall see in a few moments, for whatever hope of knowledge they might have, rather than this external work. They really, under this is where they had come. We easily see the moral confusion, but the epistemological confusion is worse. If there are no universals, how do we know reality from non-reality? Does that sound familiar to some of you? Boy, I'll say. Dozens and dozens of you pass through my door. How are you going to know reality distinct from non-reality in this situation? Then, of course, coming quickly on past Jean-Jacques Rousseau and only summarize, Immanuel Kant said about the same thing in different terminology. Then we come to Hegel. Hegel brings a big epistemological revolution. Hegel's revolution is not basically Hegelian materialism, something like this. It's flaming, flaming epistemological revolution. And he says, we've gone on all these times since the theory of the Greeks, and we've tried to find answers in the area of reason, plus rationalism. And as we've done this, we've gone nowhere. We've come to a wall. So consequently, let's change the whole epistemology. And instead of thinking in terms of antithesis, A is not on A, let's scrap the lot, and let's just say everything is synthesis. Thesis, antithesis, or antithesis, synthesis. This was an epistemological revolution. Don't think of Hegel largely in terms of political revolution, or moral revolution, or governmental revolution, though it's all there. But it's basically an epistemological revolution. These lectures I'm giving, these last two times, I think are the most basic areas of thinking, maybe for any century, but certainly for ours. So now we find at this place, of course, the next step, and you come to Kierkegaard, and I'm assuming all the detail in the book. And Kierkegaard, of course, did something that no man had ever done before exactly the same way. He made an absolute dichotomy between reason and non-reason. With Kierkegaard and Kierkegaardian, there was a complete smashing of any concept of a unified field of what have I written in every book? Knowledge! Do you know what you were reading? What Kierkegaard did was not destroy something else less than this. Kierkegaard's step was an acceptance of a dichotomy in the area of knowledge. From then on, the world indeed has changed. Now we're into the modern, really modern way of thinking. From now on, all you have is a divided field of knowledge, totally. Now, there are three forms of existentialism, French, German, Swiss, all these things. But when you get all done, none of these things make any difference whatsoever, because we find, though there are distinctives between the schools of existentialism, it is the same system. It is the same system. Namely, the rationality only leads to something horrible. Rationality only leads to something utterly horrible in the area of everything, including knowledge. It's a horrible thing I face if I live in this world. Horrible! Some of you have felt the horror of great darkness at this point. Horrible! At this place we find, therefore, regardless of the different forms of existentialism, I face in the area of rationality, coming as a rationalist. The game is played to the end, and in this area, there's only, including knowledge, there's only this horrible darkness. And so for them, as rationalists, the knowledge we can have only leads to what? To mathematical formula. It only leads to mathematical formula, in which man is only a machine. Now we've come to the place where man indeed is only the machine. But you can have mathematical formula down here. You remember my heavy, heavy wall here. And as I come to it after Kierkegaard, reason, non-reason. And so down here, what can you have? Well, down here in the era of reason, you have mathematical formula, and that is means that man equals the machine. And that's all. So instead of reason, they hope to find some sort of mystical experience apart from reason to provide what? Don't you see they're seeking for a universal? This is what they're seeking for. And here we can feel again the drift of the hippie movement and the drug culture too. Man hopes to find something in his head because he is no longer certain that there is anything out there. Whatever you're going to know, it must be in here, because you're not certain there is even anything out there, or certainly no way to be sure of knowing it. So we're now down and we can see the hippie movement streaming off Jean-Jacques Rousseau, streaming off this thing of the Kierkegaardian world. Here we are. I am convinced that the generation gap is indeed basically in the area of epistemology. Men before this had a romantic hope that on the basis of rationalism, they were going to be able to find out a meaning of life and put universals over the particulars. But on this side of Rousseau, Kant, Hegel, and Kierkegaard, this hope no longer exists. The hope is given up. Young people today live in a generation that no longer believes in the hope. The truth is truth. This is why I use the word true truth to emphasize the real truth. And this is not a tautology. It is a total omission that the word truth now means something that before these four men would not have been considered truth at all. Now we're ready to understand. And I really do ask you to pray for this book. I believe this is the most important thing, certainly, I've ever worked through. I've worked over it for how long? 40 years, I guess. 40 years, something like this. Certainly 35. So when we get this book, pray, if you will, for he's there and he's not silent, because I think then we have come the whole way into this, the heart of this dilemma. Now, after Kierkegaard, rationality is seen as leading only to pessimism. I'm sorry. After Kierkegaard, rationality is seen as leading into pessimism. We can have mathematical knowledge, but man is only a machine. And any kind of optimism that one could have concerning meaning would have to be in the area of non-rationality. So rationality, including modern science, will lead only to pessimism. Man is only the machine. Man is only the zero. I am nothing. I am only one particular among thousands and thousands of particulars. I die and man is dead. And here we are. So man has made his leap upstairs into all sorts of mysticism in the area of knowledge. And they are mysticisms because they are totally separated from all reality. And this is a mysticism like no previous mysticism. Previous mysticisms assume something was there. But modern man's mysticisms are semantic mysticisms. They have nothing to do necessarily with something being there. They're simply concerned with something in your head or in language in one form or another. Notice there's two possibilities. It is conformed either in your head or with language. Be sure to see this. In your head or in language, one or the other. So now we come to Aldous Huxley, and he suggests drugs. And the drug culture flows from his ideas. What is it? An attempt to find a mystical answer, meaningful knowledge, within one's own head. Of every one of our dilemmas in our own age is rooted right back in this point of epistemology. So we can think of the upper and lower, can't we? Reason and non-reason. And down here we have all this, the formula. Well, what is this? This is positivism. That's what it is. Positivism. For scientific fact, mathematical formula, man is a machine. And up here, mysticisms of many, many different kinds. And here now placed in all I dealt with in Escape from Reason and a long, long section in The God Who Is There at this particular point. Now we must turn our attention again to the downstairs positivism. This was the great hope of the rationalistic man. But gradually positivism has died. For a careful study as to why it has died, I would suggest Michael Polanyi's book, Personal Knowledge, An Introduction to Post-Christian Philosophy. Please write it. Post-critical, sorry. Personal Knowledge, An Introduction to Post-Critical Philosophy. Personal Knowledge, An Introduction to Post-Critical Philosophy by Michael Polanyi. And here Polanyi shows why positivism is not a sufficient epistemology. Why the hope of modern science to have any certain knowledge is doomed to failure. There is probably today not a really outstanding chair of philosophy of anywhere in the world that teaches positivism. When I first went to Europe, positivism was very, very strong. When I started to work in England, I had to shift gears between Cambridge and Oxford because one at that time was held positivism, one held linguistic analysis already. Today it's no longer true. Positivism is dead in almost every important chair of philosophy in the world, everyone as far as I know. Though positivism is still held by the undergraduate and by the naive scientist. Modern science is as naive at this point as the most naive freshman that ever wore a dinky hat. He's building with this kind of a happy smile on his face on a foundation that no longer exists. Positivism is gone. Polanyi argues that positivism is inadequate because it does not consider the knower in what is known. That this is its basic weakness. I agree on this point. It acts as though the knower may be overlooked, and yet he can have full knowledge of certain things. The certainty of the thing in itself apart from the knower, as though the knower knew without the knower being there. Polanyi has absolutely finished positivism. It was a dying, but he did it. Or you can say that positivism does not take into account the knower's theories or the knower's presuppositions. So you can assume that he approaches the thing without any presuppositions, without any grid through which he feeds his knowledge. And there is a dilemma, as Polanyi shows, of positivism, because this simply is not true. There is no scientist in the positivistic place who does not approach the thing already with a grid, a theory through which to feed that which he finds in the millions and millions and millions of particulars. It is not possible to look at this room without seeing it through a grid. Polanyi puts his finger on the heart of this matter. Incidentally, you know, it was not many years ago that science, if I had said this, if it was a scientist in the room, he'd have jumped up and he said, it isn't true. Science is all completely objective. Nobody says that anymore. Why? Because a relatively few years ago at Oxford, they first put forth the move and the understanding that you can't have science without an observer. You can't have science without an observer. The observer sets up the experiment, he decides what to experiment with, and he makes the conclusion whether you use a computer or whether you don't. Makes no difference. Polanyi, though it was clear, I'm sure, to Polanyi before they saw this, but then he carries it on. He says, all right, and this observer who makes science, he has a grid. So what are you going to do? Where's the objectivity? It simply isn't there. The concept of a totally innocent, objective observer is totally naive. And science cannot exist without this observer. Now, I for myself would take a one deeper step. And for about 10 years now, I've been arguing the following. And this is, in a way, it's a step under Polanyi. I've always insisted that the basic problem of positivism is that within the system of positivism, it has no way of saying with certainty that anything is there. Within the system of positivism itself, by the very nature of the case, you begin simply, nakedly, with nothing there. Must be so. Otherwise, you're acknowledging your grid. You have no reason within the system as a system to know that the data is data. It's even more profound. How do you know anything's there under your own system? Under what in your system, under what apex, under what universal can you say that there's anything there? How are you going to start after all in this area? You have no reason within the system. Notice what I've said. As a system, to know that the data is data. The system of positivism itself gives you no certainty that anything is there, that there was really, in the beginning move, any difference between reality and fantasy. In reality, except for a leap of blind, unscientific, to use their own words. Faith! These men are no different than the freak. He doesn't know there's anything and know the difference between reality and fantasy. The only distinction is a blindest leap of faith that you can imagine. Now, I think positivism really was impossible at this particular point.